Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us Fridays at this time for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning and welcome back to you from your trip.
I appreciate that. I was during the tail end of our fundraising marathon, I started each show by saying, we have great news. The Israeli election is over. It wasn't a matter of who won. It was a matter of finally getting it behind us.
That's right.
And a lot of people in Israel, as you know, felt the same way. Malcolm, to a degree, I think it's a little easier or better, or I'm not sure what word to use. Maybe you could help me out, that it was more of a definitive conclusion. I know nothing is definitive when it comes to Israeli elections and politics, but more of a definitive conclusion than the tie that everybody was expecting a week or so before the election. Do you agree with that?
That it was remarkable what the turnout was? Well, the real turnout?
The turnout was amazing, though.
The turnout, that was going to say, the first thing is that the turnout was remarkable. I think almost 1 million people voted, which is the record. You have also some remarkable results that don't get attention. There are 17 Arabs in the Knesset. 13 are members of the United List, but there are four others, including one in Likud, which nobody says when they talk about Netanyahu and the party. 30 women, many other results in terms of 71 or almost 72% turnout. And as I said many times on the show, you know, Israelis are notorious for telling the truth to pollsters and then lying at the polls. So it is not predictable, also because you have segments of the population that are underestimated. They don't, the periphery vote, other votes that people don't, those who do the assessments don't necessarily take down correctly. So it's not that there was necessarily a major shift. Also, this time you had 20% undecided going into the election who broke, not as people anticipated, more towards the Zionist camp side, but to Bibi. And that was, I think, primarily votes that were based on the security issue.
Right. Well, first of all, what's amazing is, as an addendum, as an amendment to your statement about telling the truth to the pollsters and lying at the polls, in this case, they did one thing at the polls and then lied to the exit pollers, it seems, which is an even more outrageous thing when you think about it. They went ahead and voted and then completely fooled those who were assessing the election throughout Election Day.
I can tell you that during the day, they knew that they had pretty good assessments. The ones that I were getting, that I was getting during the day, pretty close to right.
But every exit poll, as it was announced,
saying them publicly.
Yeah,
and they're not allowed to. I think
understood. But every exit poll, once the Israeli polls closed, had a tie between Labor and Likud.
No, I don't think so. I think that
every news source we saw in the first 2 hours after the polls
closed.
That was
the news source interpretations. It wasn't necessarily what the actual polls.
Yeah, but news source interpretations in the U.S. usually get it much closer. Usually get it, you know, much closer to correct than the Israelis did this time. So I would surmise, and again, you know better, but I would surmise that they literally lied to the exit pollers in many cases in terms of who they actually went ahead and voted for.
Yeah, but again, it depends on the disbursement. For instance, you know that votes, let's say in places like Borough Park, are not counted proportionate to their numbers as would Manhattan voters.
Right.
Which is often why American pollsters get things wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or draw conclusions that are wrong. It's not necessarily a prediction of who wins, but we'll say that X percentage of Jews voted a certain way. Well, they don't know how the Jews voted. First of all, too small a sample. Second of all,
right,
you know, they don't go to the communities that may not vote the way that they think. And I think that is also true in regard to the Israeli population.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they, for instance, don't count the periphery. They don't go into the Shtachim very much to count that vote. That vote shifted. Some from Bennett to Likud, some
right,
other ways that, you know, are not reflected then in an exit poll or in the polling.
Right. But back to my original point, which I don't think I communicated well, I just felt because you had warned us that this would be a weeks-long, if not months-long process once the election was over,
mm-hmm,
I thought just in general it was better to have this gap between the two major parties instead of the tie that everybody was predicting. It would make it easier to form a government, maybe spend less time on it during these weeks. Anything to that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's much better to have a clear outcome. It'd be much better if you had one party that gets a majority and then you're a minority and you didn't have also the disbursement and the loss of votes, which I think is also very sad, that 120,000 people almost were disenfranchised because they voted for a party that didn't meet the
threshold.
The threshold and came so close. But I think you're right. I think that is...
How long will it take him to form a government now?
If ever.
Well, it will still be a really long, painstaking process.
It's certainly a painful process, and painstaking it is. I will tell you yet, don't be surprised if there aren't major shifts back and forth and back and forth between with whom they're going to make a government and between the different parties. There's a lot of sensitivity, a lot of differences of view right now. Bennett is saying that he wouldn't mind being in the opposition. He wouldn't resist being in the opposition. I think right now the 67 votes are going to be are a likely formula, but it's going to be hard to cobble it together. Everybody has a lot of demands this time, and they know that each of them can leverage Netanyahu because without them, or without some of the smaller parties, he doesn't have the 67.
Right. So despite Bennett's position that he might stay in the opposition, right now we're expecting that Likud, Kahlon, Bennett would be together and eventually with the smaller parties get to the 67 seats.
That would be the expectation now, right. But it's not an assurity.
What has he... I saw on Israeli television the conjecture of who's who in the government, meaning, you know, who will serve in what ministership. Has Naftali Bennett been offered one of those?
Well, I saw the Rabbanim of Dati Lumi told him he should take education. He wanted the defense ministry.
Right.
I don't think he's going to get it, but he was offered a package. It will change many times yet before they're finalized.
So as we see the predictions of each one, it's all going to shift. And
yes.
Okay. How unfair was Prime Minister Netanyahu, as many, including some in Bennett's camp, and certainly people here in the United States, to utilize the fear of Arabs going to the polls in droves, to use that as a way to increase voter turnout, and especially voter turnout for Likud?
Well, at the time that he said it, it was true that the Arab vote was very strong, and maybe even according to an expert I had spoken to that morning, he was saying that it looks like it was greater than the Jewish turnout at that time. The Jews, many of the Jewish Israelis tend to vote later in the day. Obviously, the Prime Minister's articulation of it caused a lot of problems, and he has walked it back, including yesterday, and he met with Arab leaders afterwards. I think what he was trying to say was that this is the opposition to him and to the kind of government he wanted to form. I don't believe it was racist, and if you look at the record of Netanyahu's government, he poured hundreds of millions of shekels into the Arab, Israeli Arab communities. He did a lot in terms of educational assistance, other areas. He had special people appointed in his office to oversee it, and in fact, this is an area where they implemented a lot of things in that community. So the portrayal was unfair, but his comments it almost appeared as if he was panicked into these.
On top of that, he declared there would never be a Palestinian state under his watch. That also seemed to be more of a panic move.
Well, yes, I think the comments he made. But right. Again, there, if you look, you see that he said today, I think it was unfortunate, the comment, for all the reasons that everybody knows and the price that they paid for it and him having to come out over and over again to clarify and to reassert his commitment to the two-state solution and to all of the processes that we know.
And he knew what kind of backlash he'd get from Washington.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether he contemplated fully what the implications and how his words would be used. Look, if people say things in American campaigns, too, I think if we went back to President Obama's campaigns or George Bush's campaigns, people say things in election campaigns that they don't carry out. And often in the heat of the moment will say things for which they have to apologize.
Hey, in Israel, we're held to a higher standard. I speak like I'm somebody in Israel.
That's not the point here.
I know.
Is that, I mean, it does have real consequences. And as you see how it's being used by European countries, by others, they raise it at the United Nations all the time. They say we have to intervene now.
Well, some could argue that he should have been more careful, frankly.
He should have been much more careful. Yeah. But he did say today, he said under the current circumstances, et cetera.
Right.
So he can explain it away, but the damage, it's why we say, Hachamim, is it would be Dibrechem, that wise people are careful with their words because
right.
they can come back to haunt, and especially in an era like this, and if somebody who wants to exploit something, when the media wants to go after somebody or others, you don't see the same thing. You know, Khamenei said at the Friday prayers, somebody called out death to America. He said, yes, death to America, death to America. He bombs mock-ups of American ships. His deputy says we won't stop fighting until the Muslim flag flies over the White House, many other things. And yet there's no accountability because nobody is screaming and yelling when we're negotiating, in fact, all during this time. And here you have the prime minister put under this kind of scrutiny, and I think they went too far, and it caused a backlash in our community and outside.
Yeah, no question.
Even amongst the members of Congress
who
said enough was enough. You know, he apologized. He did what he could. There was nothing else. Would he swallow those words? He would have. And he said so. So, you know, time to move on. And the fact is, but it's being exploited in really specific ways. And maybe if they had some who wanted and who have it in for Israel, found this a very useful lever to pull and to be able then to go far beyond the issue and talk about imposition of a deal, talk about going to the United Nations for things, which would be a sure death knell to any chance of
negotiation. Right. One of the things I noticed on Israeli television is and again, it's the media, of course. I don't know if it reflects exactly what the citizenry is feeling. But there's great concern about the Obama-Netanyahu relationship. You'd think that is the number one major issue coming out of this election, if it can be repaired. First of all, is it true that this was the longest, I don't know if this was a myth that was being spread around, this was the longest that a president of the United States ever took to congratulate a winning party, a winning prime minister in an election? Did you hear that? That this was the longest that was ever taken to place a phone call?
You know, again, this is the kind of thing that everybody darshens. If you hadn't had the controversy and he didn't call till then, so he said that they usually don't call until they wanted to wait until the president actually designated Netanyahu to do it. They did it earlier because of the public exposure and pressure. Kerry had called him prime minister right away. Would it have been more natural to call earlier? Yes, but does he call most leaders who get elected? I doubt it. And again,
yeah, but when you run,
I think that the president was using every opportunity to stick it to the prime minister. This clearly was an agenda. This was not haphazard because of the continuing things, the other steps, the release of the information about Israel's nuclear program. There are other things that took place that were released, that were said, which are troubling.
Right. Well, you know, when you run against the Prime Minister of Israel, people expected the concession phone call to be earlier. You know what I mean?
Not the concession.
You get my point. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, broadcasting live from the Sonia and Robert Gold studios in Jersey City, New Jersey, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Big thank you to those who made our 2015 fundraising marathon a great success as of our big celebration day last Friday. We'll keep providing amazing programming for you every single morning and, of course, all through the day on our stream at jmtheam.org. So to close out this part of the conversation, essentially as much, and it's so funny because remember how many weeks we spoke about how security issues had basically no place in the election campaign, and it ends up that security issues put Likud in the leadership role yet again. Right? Basically, the Israeli electorate switched, many of them switched their vote because the security issue was presented the way it was by Prime Minister Netanyahu at the very end of the campaign.
And also because perhaps they feel that, you know, there wasn't much difference, by the way, on Iran, on some of these other key issues between the major parties.
Right.
I mean, it's a more
they never addressed it many
issue.
Of them. Right.
But I think that the negotiations with Iran, I think some of the things that had occurred, the increasing destabilization, what happened in the Golan now, these are things that are you know, shake up Israelis. And the bottom line is, when they came to the polling booth, many of them thought about the security issue. The economic issue was dominant, but for up until the very end, and many people disillusioned. I think that the prime minister will address it because he saw that it was key about housing issues, about the cost of living, other things, and he said this just yesterday again, that this was going to be a key focus of his new government, and being a prime minister of all the people and all the other things that, and seeking peace, etc. So again, his agenda has been affected because of what he said and what he did, but the core issues remain the same. But Israelis look at the region. They don't just look at the immediate situation, and they saw what was happening vis-a-vis Iran. They saw what's happening in the buildup around them of ISIS and other things. And that issue then was successfully communicated, that if you want security, I'm the one who can deliver it.
Right. We've got to talk about the Iran nuclear negotiations, which we will in a minute. Many of our listeners have pointed out, really through this morning, about Max Boot and his article in the Wall Street Journal. It's entitled Obama's Mideast Realignment, and the summary says on top, his new doctrine, downgrade ties to Israel and the Saudis while letting Iran fill the vacuum left by the United States retreat. What do you think of this theory?
Well, I have a lot of respect for Max Boot. He's a very astute observer, and I think people should read the article seriously. This is obviously very complicated, and this takes a long time to explain what's happening vis-a-vis Iran, but it's clear that the reports have been out there for a long time, that the administration, and there have been statements by people in the administration, that they see Iran as a potential platform for the Middle East. Here Iran talks about, during the time we were off the air last week, about the Iran plateau. They talk about Baghdad as their capital, and many people are observing that the process that we have followed now vis-a-vis Iraq is essentially turning over the keys to them, that we're bombing their enemies, ISIS, but it's Iran militia, Iran-backed Shiite militia that are taking over cities and are pushing, even challenging the Sunni population there. But broader than that, that plateau, as they said, goes to Damascus, goes to Lebanon, it goes to Hamas in Gaza, and it goes to Yemen, and today to Sudan and Libya, and et cetera. There is a major shift taking place, and there is a feeling of the absence of the American presence. It's the reason why the Arabs, and I think I mentioned it to you when we were on the air 2 weeks ago, or a week and a half ago, that Sisi's remark about creating an Arab army and that it working with the Saudis and others was a real issue, and that people should take that seriously. We see it already being exercised today in Yemen, which, as you remember, we talked about on this program for many months before the Houthis took Sana'a. We could have stopped them easily with strikes by drones and et cetera.
And now they took another major city, correct?
They've taken the third largest city. But they're on the move. And now, very belatedly, there are steps being taken to challenge. Now, the people should know the Houthis are wholly owned and armed by the Iranians. The day before yesterday, a ship docked in Yemen and unloaded 180 tons of weapons. Plus, they're building them other kind of equipment, and people who saw it in Al-Salif, which is in western Yemen, they saw the Iranian boat and this endless supply of weapons. They've been providing them with the weapons and support and financial support till now. This was the proxy war, is the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and
Iran.
Iran, but also a war with Egypt. And the Egyptians said, we will bomb if they close the straits at Bab al-Mandab, which is a very critical entrance. And for them, for shipping from the Suez, but from the Indian Ocean, Persian Gulf, et cetera.
Right.
So people shouldn't dismiss what happens in Yemen. I've said it all along that it was critical. This is exactly what we anticipated would happen.
Well, for people like me to easily understand this, what Iran has basically done with Hezbollah and Hamas and, you know, all the groups that are, you know, terrorizing Israel over all these years, essentially they're Iran's proxy. That's what they're trying to do, is create a proxy state in Yemen, right? Same basic concept, correct?
We're aiding Iran-backed forces to take, to Crete. We're taking, we backed these forces. We've allowed them, because we wouldn't, we bombed Al-Qaeda in Yemen, but we wouldn't bomb ISIS, which is, I mean, Houthis, who are a ragtag group. Now ISIS is there as well with terrorist organization. They blew up the mosques. If you remember, 135 people killed last weekend.
A Houthi presence in Yemen is Iran's presence in Yemen,
purely
right?
In Iran's right. presence. It's the proxy war, as I said. They right. want to take over. It's part of the expansion of their caliphate. And they say we control for the first time four Arab capitals.
Who does Saudi Arabia look to prevent this? Or do they want to get involved themselves and try to...
They are doing it. They are... They,
militarily.
They, together with a 10-nation coalition, they say, but it's primarily Egypt, Jordan, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, maybe Kuwait. Even Qatar may join them in this particular battle. It's not clear, but at least we'll be more neutral, to go after the Houthis. There are no troops on the ground, but they're bombing them. They bombed this morning. Groups, there are going to be a lot of civilian casualties. I think already more than 24.
What does the White House say about what's going on in Yemen?
So we are giving tactical or intelligence support to the forces who are fighting there. I don't know if it'll have a spillover to the talks, but it should, because Iran is showing its aggressive designs. Country after country allowed to continue. We see them much more aggressive, and we have to talk about the Golan because it's another aspect of the same thing. Iran's activities should be shaking everybody up. And the fact that at the negotiations we're weakening our positions when we should be toughening everything up. They said, in fact, Iranian officials said that the attack of Houthis in Yemen will expand across the border into the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which is where the oil is, but where they have the large Shiite population. They say it again and again. They tell us what they're going to do. People don't take them seriously. It's the same lesson of history that we've seen so often. And we dropped the ball on it. The Iranians are expanding their sphere of influence, and we seem to be saying that this is okay.
Right.
That's how the Arabs certainly interpret it.
And if there was such a thing as publicly strengthening ties, because any tie I describe now has to be done privately for obvious reasons, then Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Jordan would certainly, or might certainly, be strengthening ties with Israel for the very reasons you say. Because they are assuming that Israel is the only one who eventually is going to be able to take care of Iran.
That is the assumption they've been working on all along, although I think that there's less of that assumption than we saw in the past. But there are clearly reports about some cooperation or some interchanges, maybe intelligence or whatever that is taking place. But you're seeing for the first time the Arabs taking control of their own fate and exercising it out of frustration, in part out of the anger at the West and the lack of what they see, the response. You know, Petraeus said it right. He said Iran is part of the problem, not the solution. And
right.
others have said it, too. And I think Max Boot's comments
outline it.
Reference that as well.
Right. Assad in Syria this Sunday night on 60 Minutes will say that he welcomes the United States' participation in negotiations to end the civil war in Syria. Why would he say that publicly?
What he's really saying is that he wants to play a role in the negotiations, because the United States said he has no role. But, you know, they criticized Netanyahu for flip-flopping, but we saw Secretary Kerry one day said that Assad should be part of the talks, and the next day the White House said Assad has no role in the talks because of what others feel. So this is an attempt on Assad's part to make himself relevant to the process. And the question is, does he remain in the ultimate outcome, or do they negotiate some exit for him? The Iranians have said that in any solution, he has to stay in power. The Russians back him strongly. The talks are going to take place in Russia. So I wouldn't anticipate any major breakthrough or outcome. They are feeling the pressure. Remember, both Iran and Russia are hurt badly by the drop in oil. So the continued need to extend themselves and provide assistance is a bigger and bigger drain. They also, everybody is looking at the overall situation and the continued destabilization of the region. And Assad, is, who controls, 20% of the country, 30% of the country, they made a little bit of progress recently, but by and large, his troops are on the defensive. And if it weren't for the backing of IRGC and Hezbollah and others, he would have been out a long time ago.
I just read about oil prices going up because of what's happening in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, etc. Is that going to affect oil prices for consumers in the United States?
The impact will be minimal, but it is true that prices will go up. I think it's temporary because I think people will see that this is not going to affect the production by and large anywhere, certainly not for the United States. Whenever there is unrest, and especially in areas where you have oil production, it affects. It's very sensitive to oil prices, especially when they're down as dramatically as they are. But I haven't heard anybody of the oil experts predicting that there will be any rebound of significance now.
Malcolm, did Israel spy on U.S. negotiations with Iran? Excuse me?
No, I don't know what I said. That they said that they did not spy on the United States. It has been the policy of Israel since the Apollo affair not to spy on Israel. I believe that they did not spy. That doesn't mean they haven't got intelligence on Iran. And the Iranians talk. It's part of the issue that people always say to me, how did you know this and that? Because people talk. They tell things. And we got reports all during the night about the talks in Geneva. From that they started at 10:08, not at 10 o'clock, as reported, and telling us what people have for lunch. And during the night, there are people there who are twittering and sending reports about increased concessions, and especially the concessions that are being reported now on the PMD, which is passing the military dimensions. And people will say again that it's technical. It's not technical. It means the verification will be impossible or much more difficult.
By the way, I just checked with our high school students here. The verb is tweeting, Malcolm. That would be the verb. Not twittering, but tweeting, rather.
That's the other system.
It's the 27th of March. Wasn't there supposed to be some type of conclusion to these Iran negotiations by now?
Well, first it was 24th, 27th. It's the 31st of March. I told you that that was the anniversary of the date, but it's really the 31st. And the likelihood is that we will not get a written document, that if there is an agreement, and I don't know that all the things that we just talked about, and especially the fact that Congress reacted immediately, 100-0 vote in the Senate, there are 10 amendments that were introduced, there are all sorts of resolutions about reimposing sanctions and demanding full disclosure, etc., that this is a critical issue that we are postponing, supposedly, action, that is to disclose all of their past activities, when they began. Why is that essential? Because then you have to know, in order to be able to measure it, to be able to counter it, to be able to have transparency and investigations, you need to know this information. It has to be disclosed. It can't be clandestine operation. They're talking about allowing Fordo now to continue, that the centrifuge will spin, but they won't spin uranium. They'll reprocess something else. But once you leave everything intact, they cheated all along, and as Ali Heinen had said, if they're not, who was the former chief inspector at the IEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, if they do not have a clandestine operation, a secret operation, then it'll be the first time in 20 years that they didn't.
Yeah.
So what the IEA told us in Vienna is that it's not the places we know about. It's not what we don't know about the places we know. It's the places we don't know about that worry us.
Yeah.
And they don't have the resources, they don't have the manpower, they don't have the technical abilities to really do the kind of surveillance that we're all talking about.
It's interesting because I don't know at this point what is holding up an American conclusion to the negotiations with Iran. I mean, what could...
Well, France is, because France is taking a much tougher line. The Iranians have not agreed to certain things. There are still... things that separate them. This idea that somehow there was a fatwa, which the president again made reference to, though nobody, including the fact checker at the Washington Post, could come up with any evidence that people have reviewed all the fatwas that were issued, meaning the religious rulings by Khamenei, which allegedly said came out against developing nuclear weapons. Nobody has been able to find it. And the head of the IEA, Amano, said there's been little headway in some of the things that they know, and especially about the military ambitions. And if we made a concession on that, I think Congress will react very heavily to that. And we've already, as I said, pointed to some of the signs. So there are details, there are things that are holding it up, but the perception, at least, especially in the Arab world, is that the West keeps moving, the P5+1, especially the U.S., keeps moving, and the Iranians hold tight. They make some slight concessions, but nothing that really undermines their ability. And the fact is that, as somebody told me last night, it's more of an arms control agreement. We don't deal with the regional problems. We don't deal with all their activities and terrorism. It doesn't address any of the other issues. And even on this, it doesn't dismantle anymore. It contains. And I think that all the promises, the initial Security Council resolutions, and the danger here is that they will not go to Congress, but they could go to the UN, to the Security Council, and get a vote on this agreement, and an executive agreement. It doesn't have to go to the Senate, but it can go to the UN. You get passage of it, so it has a force in international law, supposedly. And, Congress will then look at sanctions, and the Europeans will be lifting sanctions, and the Europeans will be running after the money from Iran.
The congressional approval is the congressional approval or disapproval is essentially irrelevant.
It depends on the nature of the agreement, although administration leaders said over the last few days that it would come to the people, we'll bring it to Congress, we're going to review it. I don't think that they're going to review it because I'm not sure that the details will be worked out. They may go for a framework agreement, meaning that the March 31st deadline is too soon, and Kerry already said today that, it doesn't have to be by then. Remember, this is the third extension of the talks, so we're going to do more extension. In the meantime, they buy more time. They're operating under the JPOA, the joint proposal, the agreement. Their sanctions largely remain in place, but there is an erosion, and the more time they get, the more time they can. They're still doing their research and development. It's another issue that wasn't covered in the agreement, which means that they can develop the next and the next and the next generation of centrifuges. The ballistic missile program is not covered. Weaponization is not covered. They say they will not dismantle the heavy water plant. So it seems to me there are a lot of issues, and if we're not going to address those issues, then these talks will not have produced an outcome that will give any sense of security.
Yeah, well,
Jordan already signed a $10 billion deal with Russia to build nuclear reactors. Saudi Arabia contracted for 15 reactors, and many more are going to do the same.
Who can blame them?
I mean, if you're in that situation, nobody's going to want to be left behind.
No question about it.
And they're very much afraid, and they see the reality of Iran's ambitions. And if you know that yesterday Erdogan, the crazy man from Turkey, who has his own aspirations to rebuild the Ottoman Empire, attacked Iran, with whom they had in the past been aligned, talking about their aspirations to create hegemony in the region and to take over the region. There's no one who doesn't talk about it, who doesn't have a fear, and the Europeans should be really scared, because the missile program that they developed is can today target much of Europe.
And we see
360 congressmen send a letter to the president reminding them that permanent sanctions relief, as part of a deal, it would require new legislation from Congress, and saying they're going to hold it up, and holding the administration to account.
All right, we got to run. Rabbi Yudin's Shabbos HaGadol words coming up. Before we wrap up, Malcolm, we lost Ambassador Yehuda Avner this week. How about a message to the youth of our community about the impact that one man can have on Jewish history?
Well, I hope all of them will honor his memory by reading the Prime Minister's, and you see the role that somebody who came out of, I think, B'nai Akiva, and was somebody who wore a yarmulke throughout his career and worked with different prime ministers, earned their respect and admiration. And we extend the condolences to his family, especially to the Sables. And the role that he played, I think, is will still be written about, and people should read the obituaries about how significant his place, not as out front, and he saw himself, unlike sometimes people who surround leaders, can't distinguish with who's the leader and who's not. he knew, and that was part of his effectiveness.
No question.
During his career.
No question. Malcolm, thank you so much. Next week, it's Erev Pesach. We will conduct a weekly update, and we look forward to it. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Good
Shabbos. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. I don't know where Malcolm will be next Friday, Erev Pesach. We got to find out. I just assumed we're doing the weekly update. I don't know what time of day or night or afternoon we'll be asking him to participate. We'll have to find out because I don't know what time zone he'll be in next week.